What a roller coaster ride it had been. Here comes this fella after all these years, and he tells us that God sent him to lead us out of bondage. And he goes to see Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go," and Pharaoh cracks down. It looks worse than it did before. And time again, cycle after cycle, 10 times he goes before Pharaoh. And every time, it doesn't look real good. It was a roller coaster ride. But then this fella tells us that this is the last one. Get ready. Got some special instructions how you're to prepare for this last plague. And be ready to move out, because as soon as it's over, Pharaoh's going to let you go. And they do. And over the wails and cries of the weeping Egyptians who lost their firstborn, the Israelites loaded up and got out of Dodge. And they thought that you almost have to put it in context and think that they were singing, free at last, great God Almighty, we're free at last. And they moved toward the land of the promise, and you wonder what was in their mind. What was this promised land going to look like? Am I ever going to have to strike a lick of work again? They say it's a land of milk and honey. I believe I'll just be able to sit in my house and it'll all come to me. What a deal. And then they camp by the water. And then they see the torches and hear the rumble of chariots behind them and say, uh-oh, Pharaoh thought about it again. And this isn't going to be good. I wish that Moses fella had left us alone in Egypt. But then God comes through. What a miracle. The waters part, the ground dries up. We go across on dry land. But if we crossed on dry land, then Pharaoh can cross on dry land too. That's not good. He's got horses and chariots. We're afoot. Can't be a good thing. But then they watch in shock and awe as the waters crash together and Pharaoh's army is destroyed. And then they sing. Miriam sings and Moses sings and they talk about God's great deliverance and everything's good. But then shortly after that, they're thirsty. And they go to a place, but the water's bitter. And they complain. And God allows Moses to sweeten the water so that they can have their thirst quenched. But then right after that, they get thinking about it and say, I'm hungry. Reckon what we're going to eat on the way to this promised land. I don't see any milk or honey anywhere. And they began to complain. They are not too different than we are. And we'll see that as we dive into this a little bit here this morning. Exodus 16th chapter. It's written, "And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came out to the wilderness of Sin, in between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and ate the bread so full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assemblage with hunger." How quickly we forget. How quickly we forget God's miracles. You know, those folks had seen it. And we can sit here and we can say that if that had been us, we wouldn't have complained. Au contraire, mon frère. We are human beings, and fallen man has an anti-faith component. We're worried about what makes us comfortable today. We're worried about how I feel right now. We're worried about not what happens tomorrow or the next day or the day after that. We're all involved in what's going on right now. I'm hungry. I feel like I'm starving to death. You remember the story of Esau? What do I care about God's promise? I'm starving to death. It'd been too long since he had breakfast, and he sold his birthright for a pot of stew. How quickly all human beings in every age have done the same thing. They can look at the great things of God and the glory of God and the fact that God had come through and forget it 5 minutes later when something uncomfortable happened. How many of you have been in a great service and the Holy Spirit was there and moving, and you're walking about 3 feet off the ground when you leave, and some jerk pulls in front of you while you're pulling out of the parking lot? And you forget it all for that moment. How quickly God has come through, and then the next hurdle comes along and it looks like that mountain is way too big. There's no way God can come through. Oh, wait a minute. He just came through on a mountain equally as big. How quickly we forget. You've got to wonder, what did those people expect? Well, let's paint a picture of where they were first. 430 years before, Joseph, who had been sold into Egypt by his brothers, had been there for 13 years, from age 17 to age 30. And God, through His miraculous power, elevates Joseph to a position of authority in Egypt. And by and by, He brings his family down to Egypt. And it was a good thing. There was a famine in the land. There was food in Egypt because God had enabled Joseph to prepare for this famine. And it was also a good thing because this family of 70 individuals could in no way have possessed the promise of God. God had promised him this huge piece of property, and a family of 70 couldn't possibly possess it. So God brought them to a safe place. He brought them into the land of Egypt, where the economy was good and the food was good, and they weren't a threat to anybody. You see, if they'd stayed in the land and they started to grow and become more wealthy and powerful, then the inhabitants of the land would say, you know what, I'm afraid of those people. Let's sneak up on them at night and wipe them out. We'll take their stuff, we'll take their women, we'll kill their men, and their stuff will be ours and they won't be a threat anymore. That was the way of the world in those days. So God takes them and He puts them in this place in Egypt. He had told them before that they would be sojourning in a foreign land for 430 years, and so they did. And we often say that they spent that whole 400 years enslaved, but that is not true. Joseph was 30 years old when he came to power. He lived to 110. Joseph was greatly revered by those who he had saved from starvation. And he was also greatly revered by the government in Egypt at that time, who was enriched by all the people. So, well, I don't have anything else to give you, governor, for food, so you have to take my land, take my cattle, take us as your servants. So the government had been enriched. Joseph was highly honored. And the Bible tells us that that kind of went on until a king arose who knew not Joseph. There was a dynasty change. There was something that happened. If you follow the history of Egypt, they had a lot of dynasty changes. The time in which Joseph would have gone into Egypt was a time of some turmoil. It was a divided kingdom, northern and southern at the time. There are no pharaohs of note in 1650 B.C., about when Joseph would have gone into Egypt. And Joseph lives 80 years there, and the people are given good land in the land of Goshen. They've got their flocks and herds, and they begin to greatly increase. Remember, God planted that seed of Israel into Egypt so that He could nurture it until it was time for the baby to be born. The baby would be born 430 years later, that's a long pregnancy, by the hand of Moses, who brought them out. So they grow and they prosper, and by, the Bible says, a king arose that did not know Joseph, and he looked at him and said, you know what? This is dangerous. We have got a border security issue here. We've got all these foreign people out there who want to take our land and take our resources, and right on the main highway that those invaders will come through is this foreign people living here in the land of Goshen. What if they side with our enemies against us? Sounds like the thinking of a military man. What if these foreigners living in our midst decide to side with our enemies, and then all of these Israelites will be fighting against us? This is a dangerous thing. We need to do something about this. We need to put them down. But they're a good resource. So what are we going to do? I've got it. Let's enslave them. Let's put them under our control. Let's not let them have their weapons. Let's put them to work. They're a good resource. So we will take these people and we will not let them have their freedom. Therefore, they won't be able to side with our enemies against us. Sounded like a good logical plan. Didn't work. Enslaved people aren't supposed to grow and prosper, but God had promised them they would grow and prosper in Egypt, so they keep growing and prospering. And they're not becoming less, they're becoming more numerous. Still got a problem. What are we going to do? Well, let's tell them to kill their baby boys. We'll talk to the midwives, and as they're there giving birth, we'll cause them to say, you know, if that's a boy being born, kill it and say it died. Well, the midwives were not playing that game. They were followers of God, and they knew that life is precious and right is right and wrong is wrong, and they cooked up a cover story and said, no, we're not doing that. So finally, the edict comes down. You will throw all of your baby boys into the Nile. And this happens about 80 years before the events that we just read about. Because you see, Moses was one of those babies that was supposed to be thrown in the river. So we know that they were enslaved at least 80 years at the end of this 430-year sojourn. Probably some more, but not the whole 400. At some point, they were enslaved. If you look at the traditional history of the nation of Egypt, there is a timeline of pharaohs. And there's an interesting sidelight there. If The Exodus is about 1220 B.C. And 80 years before that would have been about 1300 B.C. And about 30 years before that, there was a rogue Pharaoh on the throne, a fellow named Akhenaten. And Akhenaten decided that there were not a whole plethora of gods as the Egyptians had worshipped for centuries, and as an established priesthood for each and every one of those gods and goddesses was out there. Akhenaten decides to swim upstream and says, there's one God. I wonder if he knew the Hebrews. Of course, he said the God was Aten, the sun disk. And he threw all of Egypt into a turmoil. He decided that we're going to build a new capital city that is dedicated to Aten. We're going to call it Amana. And we're going to create this new city. And we're all going to worship one God, and all these old gods are dead. How do you think that went over in Egypt? He had an automatic group of enemies with the old priesthood of the old gods. Akhenaten didn't last long. Shortly following him, by the way, somebody you've heard of. Akhenaten's son was born and named Tutankhaten. When he took the throne at age 9, he changed his name to Tutankhamun. He took Aten away from it because, you see, this new religion, this new monotheism that his father had proposed had blown up in his face. But I just wonder, you know, it struck me as curious. I wonder if the Hebrews and their belief in one God was kind of lumped into Akhenaten's belief in one God, and the real persecution of the Hebrews might have begun as a kickback when they threw out the monotheism that Akhenaten tried. Don't know. It's a possibility. But these people, you know, like I said, for at least 80 to 100 years, they had been put down. They had been told what their work was. Now, they had plenty because they had their crops and herds still. They were able to eat. They were well treated. But they were told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And the quota was expected to be there, and they got beat when it didn't happen. It was a bad spot. So this is where these people that followed Moses out of the land had this servile mentality. They were told what to do. They were told when to do. They didn't have to make their own decision. But yet, we're fat and happy. I mean, you know, we're still eating good. I know where my next meal's coming from. And along comes this Moses fellow and says, hey, remember the promise God made to your fathers? That we were going to have a good land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and we can be free, and we can go to this land. And some of them had to sit there and say, you know what? It's not that bad here. I believe that the enslavement of the people of Israel was birth pangs. You know, a baby in the womb has got it pretty good. They're warm, they're well fed, they're reasonably comfortable, and they're reasonably safe. It's a whole other world when they come out. But what causes that baby to come out? Pain, contraction, squeezing, pushing. The enslavement of the Israelites were birth pangs. See, what God had planted in the safe womb of Egypt 430 years before had now come to term. And it was time for this new nation to be born. And they're born passing through the waters of the Red Sea, which is a birthing metaphor, which I'm not going to get into right now. They were called, they were chosen. It was a generation that was supposed to come out of their enslavement. But for all of the coming out of Egypt they did, apparently they didn't get Egypt out of them. See, if you live in an environment for your entire lifetime, and all of a sudden the change comes and you're moved to a different status in life and a different environment, it's hard to change. You've learned how to deal with things. You've learned how the world works. You've learned what reality is. And when you come out of that environment into a new environment, when somebody says you're no longer a slave, you're free, it causes problems. You know, to take it to American history, for all the great things of emancipation and the end of slavery at the end of the Civil War, how many of those people do you suppose said, what do I do now? I don't know how to do things on my own. I don't know how to make my own decisions. Master's made my decisions for me. I don't know how to live free. I've never had that necessity. How do I acquire a place to live? How do I go about getting a job? You know, it was quite a shakeup. It was a great blessing, but the result of that great blessing was a great bit of discomfort for at least for a period of time. Let's take that to us. Egypt is a place of slavery. Egypt is a place where we are bound up in sin, metaphorically speaking. And when the Holy Spirit comes to lead us out of that into a life of victory in Jesus, we sometimes don't know how to handle it. And we default to what we've always learned. You see, these people, you know, I posed a question earlier, what do you think they expected? Did they expect a free ride? Did they expect not to have to work, not to have to expend effort in order to live? What kind of fantasy picture do you suppose they had of the land of the promise? And did they think they were going to step right out of Egypt and right into the promised land with no transition and no pain, no shakeup, nothing uncomfortable in the whole process? Now, God's sensitive. He's sensitive to them. Scripture says very clearly, He took them through the wilderness so they wouldn't go on the main road so that they wouldn't face opposition and warfare, because He was concerned that if they had to face warfare, they couldn't handle it. They'd want to run back to Egypt. Hello, they wanted to run back to Egypt anyway. What are we doing? Where are we going to get food? Wait a minute, didn't you come out with your flocks and herds and you're already worried about where you're going to eat? I think you got some animals there with you, you know? But God's going to take care of them. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'll rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they'll walk in my law or not. And it shall be on the sixth day they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." Relatively simple instructions, right? Gonna send you meat, gonna send you bread, gather double on the sixth day, cook it then, rest on the seventh. Simple instructions. How many know you give people simple instructions, they'll find a way to do something else? Well, it happened with them too. God's going to confirm it. And He shows this whole deal. Moses and Aaron took this message and they shared it with the children of Israel. He said, "At evening you'll know that the Lord's brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for He hears your complaints against the Lord." Wait a minute. Said they were complaining against Moses and Aaron, and here Moses and Aaron tell them, "You're complaining against God." When you're complaining against the man of God, you're complaining against God. But what are we that you complain against us, basically? Yeah. Hey, me and Aaron, we're just doing what God says. You know, you can complain against us all you want to. Talk to the big guy. Take it upstairs. "This shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat this in the evening and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints which you make against Him." What are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. And Moses spoke to Aaron, said, "Say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for He has heard your complaints." Now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. Hey, I got this. If you're smart enough to look and see the sign, my men are telling you what to do, and I'm going to confirm that. Whew, here I am. But even with that, they don't listen. He tells each man to gather, in verse 16, "Let every man gather it according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent." An omer is about 2 to 3 quarts. So gather this much of this manna that I'm going to send you. Gather that much for each person. Take it to your tent. So then the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. Take this much for each person in your house. I won't take more. I don't need that much. See, they can't even obey a simple instruction. You know, you'd think people who had been enslaved their entire lives could obey an instruction. I'm free, I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to worry about those details. God loves me. How many modern Christians get in serious trouble for saying something like that in their hearts? Wow. Some more, some less. "So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack." See, God took care of them anyway. Ah, these kids. I'll clean up their mess for them. "You gathered too much, no leftovers. You didn't gather enough. Well, I'll take care of you anyway. I'll multiply it. I'll be sure you're well fed." Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it till morning." Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, and some of them left part of it till morning, and it bred worms and stank. I bet their tent stank too, where they had it hidden. And Moses was angry with them. Can't you follow a simple instruction? "So it was on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, 'This is what the Lord said, tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you need to bake today, boil what you need to boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning.' So they laid it up until morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there worms in it. Then Moses said, 'Eat that today, for today is the Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find any in the field. 6 days shall you gather it, but on the seventh, the Sabbath, there shall be none.' Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord's given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for two. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day.'" You see, those folks couldn't get it in their head that God's got a way of doing things. They couldn't get it into their head that if you follow the instructions that He gives in His Word, you'll walk in an area of blessing. And if you refuse to follow them, you'll walk in an area of cursing. It's a very simple instruction. Hey, if you go down the right-hand aisle, it's going to be good. If you go down the left-hand aisle, trouble awaits. You try to go down the middle aisle, you're going to be bouncing back and forth between the other ones. Simple, right? But we all want a Frank Sinatra it, saying, I did it my way, because after all, I'm smarter than God, which we don't say, but what's what we're actually saying. I think that a lot of these folks thought that they were going to come out of Egypt, and they were going to walk right into the land of promise, and they were going to be able to sit in their easy chair and have meat and bread drop in their mouth. But you see, it's never been that way. Remember, a few years later, what's going to happen? Moses has died, the whole generation that doubted God has perished in the wilderness, and a new generation's about to go in. And in the first chapter of Joshua, God speaks to Joshua and He says this, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, as I said to Moses. If you want to possess that which God has given to you, you must act on it. We act on the promise. We act in faith. We act with belief. These people expected, apparently, to not have to expend any effort to walk into the promise. It's almost as if I were to pile up a stack of gold right here on the side of the stage and say, hey guys, at the conclusion of the service, come up and get a brick. Get one brick each, and you can have it. We would have some people that tried to load up a double armload. We would have some people that would expect somebody else to get it for them. And then we would have others who say, nah, he didn't believe that. Yeah, he didn't mean that at all. I can't do it. Besides, I'll have to pay tax on it. No, I'm just not going to get it. Are we not that way with God? Do we not look at God's promises? Do we not look at the blessings that He offers us? And some of us will greedily try to grab all of them, whether we need them and are entitled to them or not. Some of us will expect somebody else to bring it to us. Some of us will expect God to run us down and shove it in our pocket. And others will say, that ain't for me. He doesn't like me that much. I'm not worthy. You see, faith is an active word. Faith cannot be passive. We can be still and know that He is God, certainly. But when it comes to possessing His promises, when it comes to growing in His Word, when it comes to growing in His truth, when it comes to growing as a Christian into a place of maturity, we can't be passive. We've got to actively pursue God. We've got to go to where God is as far as spiritually speaking. We've got to get into His Word to find out what He says. We've got to get into prayer to interpret what He says. We've got to gather together with the saints in order to be strengthened and encouraged. And if God says, I have promised you thus and so, you just need to go pick it up at the corner. For heaven's sake, go to the corner and pick it up. Expend some effort. Don't expect it to be easy. Preacher, what are you saying? You can't say we have to work for stuff because that's works, that's not grace. God's grace, really. No, you can't earn it, but yes, you have to possess it. Joshua didn't earn the land. He didn't deserve the blessing. God gave the blessing, and God said you can possess it as long as you go walk on it. These people who left Egypt, who left that place of slavery time and again in the Exodus story through that 40 years in the wilderness, they said, oh, I wish I was back in Egypt. They had good food in Egypt. And here we are kicking around the backside of the wilderness. Well, first of all, if you hadn't been faithless, you wouldn't have been kicking around the backside of the wilderness for 40 years. It was a journey of less than 2 weeks. You know, you could have gone in if you believed that God could do it. But no. Let's go check it out first. Let's send some spies in, see what it looks like. Let's reconnoiter. And the report comes back. Joshua and Caleb say, yeah, let's go. God's with us. Doesn't matter who's against us. Those other 10 fellas were awed by what they saw. Strong cities, standing armies. We look like grasshoppers in our own eyes compared to them. You notice where that comes from? Their own eyes. They're not making God too small in their eyes. They're making themselves too small in their eyes, not realizing that God's with them and He's bigger than all of them. And what do the people say? We better not risk it. They took the report of the 10 instead of the 2 that stood in faith. That cost them 40 years in the desert. That cost them their ticket into the promised land. Because all who were adults at that time and participated in that decision died in the wilderness. And it was the next generation that went in. All because of unbelief. Do we, modern Christians, believe that what this book says is the truth? If we do, why don't we judge by it? Why don't we think by it? Why don't we act by it? Why don't we speak what it says instead of what CNN says? Why don't we stand for what's right and stand for what is true? Or are we just as faithless as those Israelites were when they came out of Egypt? Or a generation later, are we ready to go into the land of the promise? Or are we going to go around the mountain again? I want to tell you this. This is an old theme at New Hope Church. How many times are we going to make a circle in the wilderness? For years and decades, we have approached the gates of the land of promise. And we've seen a barrier in front of us, which, by the way, was prophesied to be paper, for those of you who've been around a while. We see the barrier and turn around and go for another lap around the wilderness. Are there challenges? Sure there are challenges. In this time especially, do you realize 2 weeks from today should be the one-year anniversary of the first time I stood in this pulpit as your pastor, except we didn't have church because the governor said no, and we looked around and didn't know enough about coronavirus to know that we could come and wear a mask and stay 6 feet apart and it'd be okay. It's been quite a year. We've had challenges. There's more challenges ahead. Are we going to complain about them and do nothing, or are we going to dig in and possess the land? The land's all around us. Do you realize? I assume everybody's followed the news and realized that right up this hollow this week, we've had a humanitarian disaster. We have had somebody with some bad narcotics that has killed how many in Perry County? There are three right up this hollow and another one in critical condition. That we could throw a rock from this building and hit the building. Seriously. I was thinking I heard like 12 total ODs. So listen, there's a field out there that needs God. It's a challenging time, but we don't have to quit. And I look around this room, and I know that we all know people who are not following the Lord, or who are trying to follow the Lord and stay home doing it, and not become involved. We need to build a strong church here so that we can get out there. We touch a lot of people a week right out here in this back room, right? How many of those people are coming to God? How many of them are getting a box of food? I know a lot of them get prayed for. I know that to be a fact. Anybody that asks one of our people to intercede for them, they're going to get prayed for. But we need to reach people. We need to touch people. We've all got friends. We've all got family. We've all got neighbors. Find somebody who's not serving the Lord and bring them in. Find somebody who thinks they can serve the Lord sitting on their couch and bring them in. If we're going to possess the land, we've got to start acting like we're going to be able to possess the land. In God's strength, we can do it. In His power and wisdom, we can do it. But we can't do it sitting in our tent, griping about how bad it was and how good it used to be in the old days. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do. And God has not given up on this congregation. And God has not given up on His plan for Hazard, Kentucky and the surrounding area. He is still God. He is the one who preserved us from the angel of death on the last day of Passover and birthed us into a nation. He's still God. He's still there. Manna and quail, if we need them, He'll send them. If He needs to put the fear of God into our enemies so that we can possess the land, He can still do that too. It's a matter of we're going to take Him up on it. Are we going to do what we're called to do? I can tell you this, and some of you who read one of my posts earlier this week will know this. Everything that happens is to build strength in us. Joseph could never have been the prime minister of Egypt, was he not arrogant to his brothers, sold into slavery by his brothers, falsely accused by Potiphar's wife, unjustly imprisoned, and then forgotten about by the Pharaoh's cupbearer. Joseph at 30 could do what Joseph at 13 could not do because of the scars and the bruises and the wounds. Because he grew to the man that God prepared him to be because of the rough road that he walked on. Moses, 40 years in the courts of Pharaoh with wealth and privilege, raised as an heir of the house of Pharaoh, lashes out, ends up spending the next 40 years walking around behind sheep on the backside of nowhere until the day he saw a sight that he could not turn away from. A bush that was burning was not consumed. And God spoke out of that bush and said, "Hi, buddy, you got 80 years behind you. I got your next 40 planned. You're going to Egypt." "Well, I just came from Egypt. I'm nobody. I've been falsely, you know, I committed a crime in Egypt. I'm a wanted man. And I failed because I should have done something. My people are still enslaved. And for 40 years I've been over here tending these sheep because I messed up the chance that I had." "Well, no, Moses, you're just out of time." But Moses, after 40 years walking around behind sheep, was a different Moses than the man who spent 40 years in Pharaoh's court. We've all got wounds, we've all got bruises. And God can use every one of them to bring us into the place that He needs us to be today. What I'm going to ask you to do this morning is this. I want you to pull out your spiritual mirror and take a look at it. Where have you been faithless? And I'm going to qualify that by saying that if God is calling you to do something that you haven't acted on for any reason other than God saying, "Wait a minute," you've been faithless. I've had long periods of time in my life where I was living faithlessly because God had said, "Do this," and I didn't have the guts to do this. And I think all of us are like that. And the first step in getting back on the track is realizing you're off the track. So I'm going to challenge you this morning to look inside and start again right now. The opportunities are out there. The field is white to harvest. God needs workers. And I look around the room and I don't see anybody else but those of us that are here. So guess what? You've been nominated, been drafted into God's army.